I think what seems closest to me in terms of this moment is that the way to that the best way to bring this series of talks on dependent core arising to its conclusion is to say nothing. And part of that is that this process of maturing in the practice, in the Dharma, in this life, is a process of trusting so that we can live in a way that doesn't need any explanation or any justification. We leave the retreat tomorrow to go back to our so-called lives. What is it? What would happen if the Dharma and your life were the same thing? And that's possible if there is trust. The kind of trust that allows for the Dharma to move through you, or the kind of trust that allows you to let life move through you when you don't interfere with being self-conscious or being contracted or caught or clinging. The kind of trust that allows us not to cling or be afraid, or the kind of trust that makes it possible not to hate, not to have hostility, because these things are not needed, because we trust something. We say we trust life. But it's a life where we are awake, or we are mindful, we are aware. So because to be mindful is also to be wise. To be mindful is also to understand in the moment-to-moment life we live how to stay safe, how to respond appropriately, how to be a safe person, because we can know, we can see in ourselves the presence and absence of greed, and the presence and absence of hostility, presence and absence of delusion. And in that seeing, we will know how to behave. We'll not act on the greed, not act from hostility. The list of transcendent, dependent arising, conditioned arising, is clearly not a causal chain. It isn't like we explained one is the cause of the other, but rather is the condition which is in place that allows the other next one to arise. And you find repeatedly the Buddha was very, very hesitant, seemingly, to talk about cause, but rather talked about conditions. And one of the very interesting places where a subset of the 12-fold transcendent dependent origination appears is in a list of 5 middle pieces of the chain. Number of places in the sutta, there's a list that starts with delight, then joy, tranquility, though in this list it's called tranquility of the body, happiness, and then concentration. So kind of in the middle of this list that we've been studying. But what's fascinating about this list that is that it says, for someone who is X, there's always a precursor condition before, I'll talk about that. Someone who has X, it will be that delight will arise. Delight will arise naturally from that. Delight follows. For one who has delight, joy follows. For one who has joy, tranquility of the body follows. For one who has tranquility of the body, happiness or pleasure, sukha, follows. And for one who has happiness, and one who is happy gets concentrated. It's as if water flows downhill. One leads to the other as a natural process. And this idea that there's a natural process that we can trust, that unfolds, I think is one of the great results of really understanding how the practice works or how our hearts work, that we can trust our hearts, we can trust the process. Buddhists will say over and over again that everything is impermanent, but that does not mean that they're random or chaotic. That this changing, impermanent world, there's a certain order to it, or a certain directionality that things take. There's a certain cause and condition, conditions and consequence, and one thing leads to another. If you hold a ball in your hand, 4 feet above the ground, and then let go of the ball, it will fall. In a sense, you're not the cause for it to fall, but you're letting go as a condition that allows gravity to do its work. If you live with a contracted heart, that's a condition that allows something else to happen. A contracted heart is a brittle heart. It easily gets broken, easily challenged. So then life seems much more challenging. A life which has an open heart creates different conditions. More likely, if you open heart, that's a condition for love, for friendliness, care. If you keep your hand in a fist all the time, that allows certain things to occur. But if you open your hand time to time and have your palm open, that allows something very nice usually. Some of the more tender expressions between people happen with an open hand, not the closed fist. So the same thing with the mind or the heart, that once things open, it creates the conditions for other things to follow. And this pattern of going from delight to joy to tranquility, happiness, and concentration, I don't know if it always has to go this way, but it points to a certain way that we can trust the inner natural process if we create the right conditions for it to unfold. Some people will call this something like Buddha nature. Some people cringe at this idea of Buddha nature, but Buddha nature, the idea that there is something that's good within us, something that moves towards awakening, to goodness, to health, the movement towards healing, that there's something in our psychophysical system that will move in directions of health, of wholeness, of healing, of goodness, if given the chance. And we don't have to will it, we don't have to make it happen, we don't have to be the cause for it. But in a certain way, it's kind of allowing for something to unfold. And so this is the point back to trust. To be able to have some trust in what's in there to move through. And it's not an easy thing to come to. It's not an easy way to find our way to this place. So I said that in these lists, you know, the natural unfolding of delight to joy and so forth, there's always a precursor. When X is there, then delight occurs. And in the suttas, a variety of different things are listed as the precursor, as the condition for this delight. And one of the most common ones is the hindrances have abated. One no longer is caught in the grip and the gravitational force of the hindrances. And probably all of you now, by now, should be familiar with being caught in the hindrances. If you're not familiar with it by now, you haven't been practicing. Where have you been? But you get familiar with what it feels like to have the mind be pulled off into desire, pulled off into ill will, pulled off into sloth and torpor, or restlessness or delusion. And you can feel how there's a kind of lack of control, kind of something else is in charge. The teenagers have taken over the house. The parents are out of town. You know, just and you know, kind of doesn't feel good to have these kinds of forces in charge, taking over the mind and directing us, because there's kind of, they're uncomfortable, they're kind of painful. And they cause more problems in the future. And so the idea of trying to be mindful and stay in the present moment, we have to contend with these forces that keep us from that. And then at some point, when those abate and they're quiet, and the mind is no longer tempted to go off into desire and aversion and all these things, the hindrances are no longer have any power over the mind. And then the mind is just here in a simple way. It's able to stay here, stay directed, be used to stay focused, or to be present, to be open. And it's not a lot of effort anymore to come back. It's just here. And it's such a relief, or so nice, after all this kind of manual labor, to just kind of be able to be here in this simple way, just at ease, at rest to some degree. And the abating or the lessening or the disappearing of temporarily the hindrances is one of the sources for this delight that's onward leading, that allows this healing process to unfold. But one of the things that I think I've noticed, at least in myself, is that the delight only happens if I am open to have it happen. And for a long time in my Buddhist practice, there was no role for joy or delight. So, you know, if it showed its little head, it was like, you know, forget that. That's not the real stuff. Real Dharma is like just direct contact with the truth. And truth is always serious. Something. And so, but to appreciate delight, to appreciate what's happening when it's good, to appreciate, look at this. And I suspect that there's much more to appreciate than most people allow for. I think often we have so many ideas of shoulds and shouldn'ts and have to and shouldn't be, agendas and judgments and comparative thinking, and it gets crowded in there. So it's hard to appreciate what's good here, but there's a lot more good. It's just like there's all the surface static surface waves on the top of the lake that keeps us from appreciating how beautiful it is under the water. one of the images for enlightenment, this kind of state of mature awareness, is that of a very clear lake. The water is completely clear, and you can look into the water and see the fish and the rocks there. See right through. But you know, then we have the, then when we stir up the surface of the water, we can't see down. So if we're caught up, and one of the wonderful things about stirring up the surface, you take your stick and you want it to kind of, you realize there's a problem with all the little waves you're making. So you want to get rid of them, so you take that stick and try to push away the waves, right? And that just creates more, and you know, it's just, so then of course the right thing to do is just try harder, right, with your stick. This is just kind of, but there has to be, you know, this deep stopping, some kind of deep stopping. Stop. Stop all the doing. Stop all the judging and needing and wanting and stop. So I think there's often much more to appreciate than we realize. So to know that it's okay to appreciate, actually not only okay, but it's actually part of the maturing. And when, if there's a little bit of delight that begins to show up, to allow for it, make space for it. If joy arises, make space for that, allow for it. Our job is maybe to allow for these things when they begin happening. And I think my guess is that all of you are a little bit familiar now after retreats like this about something about a natural process of unwinding, of settling, of opening up, of having of shedding things, at least temporarily, the mind getting quiet. And then with a quieter mind, maybe there's more intimacy with your oatmeal. Isn't that something? You didn't know you could be so intimate with whatever you're doing. And you start seeing a kind of ease or relaxation. After a while, you notice your shoulders are more relaxed and your jaws are not as tense as they were when you came. You find that your thoughts are not so scary anymore. It's a process of settling in and allowing. Some of you probably found that you're better off not trying too hard in the practice, but trusting or allowing, or making room for what is. So one of the things that's a precursor for delight is the quieting, the baiting of the hindrances. Another place the Buddha talked about how it's the abating, quieting down of unskillful mental states. So that's kind of similar to hindrances, but maybe wider. That no longer we're caught up in unskillful states. We don't want to make these bad or wrong to have them. We don't want to condemn anything. But it's nice when these things abate. Nice when we don't feel that we're going to be in danger of unskillful states of mind. It was one of the surprises for me, my first long Vipassana retreat, which was quite long, was a certain purity of mind that came. And the way I knew, it had a feeling of kind of being very clean, my mind. But what really stood out to me was that lustful thoughts that I had before the retreat, I was uninterested in having when I had this clean mind. It just I had no interest to touch it. It had no place in that mind. And so to feel the difference, you know, it was such a pleasure. It wasn't like one was bad, it's just one was more pleasurable, more enjoyable. It was a seed for joy to arise. Another place, the precursor for delight and joy and so forth, is confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. But it said in this text that it's the confidence that comes from knowing that sometimes the mind is obsessed with greed, and then it's possible to have that abate. Sometimes the mind is caught up in conceit, and it's possible to that to abate. Sometimes the mind is caught up in greed and hate. It goes through a long list of things. And to actually know the mind is possible to be free of it, kind of like I saw in that clean mind, my mind was free of lust temporarily, that to really see that this is possibility of the mind, to know the mind can get simpler, quieter, that it doesn't have the tendencies of unwholesome thinking, gives us a visceral, direct experience of what a liberated mind is like, what the Buddha's mind is like. In this early suttas, the reference point for this deep faith in the awakening of the Buddha is in fact the absence of these unwholesome tendencies in your own mind. It's not some abstract idea of emptiness or some wonderful disappearing of self and there's all kinds of profoundly philosophical presentations of what enlightenment might be. But here, the arising of this confidence in the enlightenment of the Buddha, it comes from really seeing what goes on in our own minds. Minds gets purer, simpler, quieter, less caught up, less contracted, more open. And I wonder if perhaps at the end of a retreat like this, whether there were moments during the retreat for you that are a reference point for that, for you. If you remember hours or sits here where your mind was caught up, really caught up, spinning around in something. But maybe there were minutes or sits where it wasn't and became quiet and simple and contented, peaceful. And that contrast is a lesson. That contrast can show you something. And that contrast, the suggestion from the sutta is that contrast is one of the ways of having faith in the awakening of the Buddha. This is possible. And to have confidence in the Dharma and the confidence in the Sangha. And with this kind of confidence or faith, then there can be delight. And from delight follows joy, and from joy follows tranquility, from tranquility follows happiness and then concentration. So as we come to the end of this retreat, one of the ways of respecting what it's like to be on a retreat like this is to somehow register in your mind some of these changes that you've gone through during the retreat, some of the places you've been and visited as you went through the retreat. To recognize and acknowledge that there are times that were difficult, but also to recognize maybe the times where something different happened that wasn't your own making, that pointed to some kind of something that was worthwhile to trust, some way of being here, of being mindful, being present, being open, that points to or is a kind of freedom, a kind of deeply satisfying way of being alive. And this natural process from delight and joy points, as I've been saying, to this, there's something within us that's knows, that's wise, that moves. The Dharma is in us, is found in us, and it can operate if we create the conditions for it. It's something we can have deep faith and confidence in. That something can operate from within us that is not ourselves, not our normal self-conscious self. that we can trust and open and allow for. And the deeper we go in the Dharma, the deeper the mindfulness meditation goes, the more helpful it is to trust something which is not, trust the Dharma rather than trust your own efforts to keep trying and pushing and making and fixing and all that. Then there's a fascinating thing in the suttas that I find very inspiring, is that it goes through this list, a number of places of, you know, delight and joy and tranquility and happiness and concentration. So you come to being concentrated. And then, as if it's the next natural thing that might happen, just kind of just follows. The concentration is a condition for what follows. Loving kindness. That love, and then the other Brahma Viharas. It's, you know, there's no explanation. It isn't like they say, well, then the person decided to practice loving kindness, and they started kind of, you know, pumping up those phrases, and you know, got them really going well, and it doesn't say that at all. It just says, and then the person was dwelling in boundless loving kindness. Radiating it all around, kind of a radiating love. And there's no explanation in these texts. That's what happens. And I think many times in the suttas, it's just assumed that if you are concentrated and at ease and peaceful, that love and compassion will follow. Now, if you're in charge of your practice and trying to get into the jhanas and trying to do something, and then maybe there's no space for the concentrated state to allow for this good inner goodness, the goodness of our heart, to begin to shine and come forth. And again, it points to the idea that there is something beautiful inside, Buddha nature, if you like, something that can shine if we have the conditions for it. We don't have to do it. And it's certainly been one of the great gifts that the Dharma has given me, the practice has given me, is to awaken or uncover my own capacity for love and compassion. It wasn't something that I was looking for or even wanted when I came to Dharma practice. But after a number of years of practicing, I hadn't made any progress in getting enlightened, but I'd gotten compassioned. And which would you rather have, compassionment or enlightenment? Be careful what you answer, because if you say enlightenment, chances are you don't know what it is. So you're kind of like going after, maybe you're going after, you know, the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, if you think you're going after enlightenment. Maybe the two aren't so separate. Anyway, so this, in the suttas at least, this assumption that once you're concentrated this way, that loving-kindness and other Brahma-viharas would just kind of naturally follow from that. So I wanted to end the talks of this retreat to talk a little bit about loving-kindness and living our lives and being in community as we... you know, in retreat where it's in community here, but as we leave, how does our practice relate to the world we're going to return to, the communities we return to? And what is the practice? What does it look like after we leave here? And maybe that depends on what your interests are. Depends on you. I don't want to say what you should do, but I'm going to tell you about a time when the community of monastics around the Buddha were quarreling. And they were quarreling over some seemingly petty issue, but they got pretty intense. And so the Buddha then gathered them together and offered them a teaching. First he said, when you're quarreling and fighting over these things, do you have loving kindness in your heart? And I think it was a rhetorical question. The assumption was, how could you? And anyway, they said no. I think here the assumption in the question is that the Buddha's assumption that monastics stay close to that capacity for love. That loving kindness is where it kind of, you find over and over again in the suttas and emphasis, kind of an assumption that those who are following the Buddha's teachings closest are going to stay close to metta, to loving kindness, to goodwill. You know, not always easy, but maybe it's easier if we learn to relax, if we learn to open up, if we're not caught up and closed down. So to give ourselves enough time and ability to be relaxed and open so our natural goodness can be there. I see that the fascinating thing that for me when I go to the supermarket, that I certainly have the capacity to be in the checkout line in a hurry to get out and hardly notice the checkout person. But I notice that if I stand there and take in the check-in, just stand there simply and just lift up my head, you know, stop studying my groceries so carefully as they go across the conveyor belt. But look, stand up and just kind of look there, take in the person, and not in an intense way, but just there. Then from time to time, the cashier looks up too. And then there's a chance for a little exchange, nonverbal and more often verbal, you know. And it kind of can be a lovely little moment there of human, basic human kindness, human goodness meeting. It doesn't take much. But it does take something. It does require me to not be so interested in the conveyor belt and what's going on. Stay with my hurriedness. I have to get to the next thing and whatever. I'll just be there. So the assumption of that the disciples of the Buddha will stay close to or value loving kindness seems to be in the Buddha's talk that he gave these quarreling monks. And then he taught them of 6 principles of cordiality. And the word that's for cordiality, the dictionary says it actually means delight, different word for delight. Amiability, friendliness. 6 principles. More importantly, it says 6 principles that bring love, respect, concord, and harmony. And unification in the community. So 6 ways in which, you know, these wonderful qualities can occur, live in our society. Love, the word is pia, but love, respect, concord, harmony, unification. These beautiful things. So he was going to teach this to these quarreling monks. And the first 3 have to do with practicing loving kindness privately and publicly. So I think what this means is that publicly means people can notice and see. Privately means no one really knows. It's kind of behind the scenes, behind people's backs or something. I don't know what. That, that time when you don't get credit for it. So public and privately one practices loving kindness with one's actions, with one's speech, and with one's mind. So we do acts of loving kindness privately and publicly. Do something friendly and kind, something nice for people. We speak nicely about people. We speak acts in ways that are friendly and generous. But even more so, we think that way. Just take the time and think. Not to force yourself, not like a Pollyannish kind of, you know, just making up nice ideas for people, you know, for them and kind of. But what happens if you stop and you think about someone and you say, what is it about that person that I can appreciate? Can you find something to appreciate? Can you find something to delight in? Can you find something about that person that you could tell someone else, you know, that person's great? Should have seen how they washed the dishes. It was great how they washed the dishes. They washed 95% of the dishes. It was great. As opposed to, I can't believe it. That person left 5% of the dishes behind. Both are, you know, true, I guess. But which, you know, what is it? How can you appreciate people? Take the time, like taking the time with a cashier. Take the time privately. And is it valuable? Is it possible to appreciate people more than you do? But again, not forcing the issue, but taking the time to discover. And I would say that there's probably something you can appreciate in everybody. And what happens when you begin appreciating that? So that's the private, that's the, you know, in your mind. So those are the first three principles of cordiality, practicing loving kindness in those three ways, body, speech, and mind. The next one is to share. And I guess this teaching is for monks, nuns, but to share what you have acquired according to the Dharma. And according to Dharma can also be translated, whatever you acquired ethically, righteously, according to the Dharma. So if you have, whatever you've acquired, whatever you've gained, share it with others. The idea of sharing. Giving gifts, offering people tea, offering them whatever, just here. You can have this. So, sometimes I've been the recipient of people's generosity like this. And the biggest gift they gave me in their generosity was not the gift, but the freedom and ease in which they offered it. Sometimes I said, wow. No hesitation, no, you're just like, here, take this. It's open-handed, it's a very relaxed, it's ease, and it's freedom in the giving. So if what you want is to create concord, if you want is to create harmony and love and respect in a community, sharing is one way. And I've known people, I've advised people to do this, I've done this, been in conflict with people and then given them a gift. I've done this. Sometimes a number of people have come to me in recent years saying that they had a lot of trouble with their in-laws. And some mother-in-law, the daughter-in-law just doesn't get along with something or vice versa. And I said, okay, well, be sure every time you go visit your mother-in-law or daughter-in-law, be sure to give a gift. Just don't make a big deal of it, but just a small thing. Just give something. And when you're there, make sure you appreciate something. Appreciate something there. Wow, this is a really nice set of dishware. and a number of these people have come back to me and said, that made a difference. I've had people come back and say, I just did metta for my mother-in-law. She didn't even know I was doing it. But something shifted and changed. So they say if you want to do is create concord, then sharing is one way. The fifth principle, I think it's more interesting, these principles. The fifth principle is practice the virtues. Be virtuous, practice virtue. I forget exactly the wording of it. But then it says, the virtues that are conducive or that lead to concentration. And the idea that your ethical life, how you live your life, your integrity, is one of the conditions that support your ability to get concentrated. And that this is a good thing. So what's interesting here is that on one hand it says, this is the way that creates concord and love and respect in the community. And it's also a way that leads you to become more concentrated. Isn't that nice? It's like you get two for the price of one. I think it's really great that there's a mutual benefit, there's a reciprocity, there's a way in which if you practice really well for yourself, you do create the conditions that support your society. Your practice and the world around you are not hermetically sealed. If you can develop greater concentration and stillness, this teaching here is that this is conducive to love, respect, concord, harmony, unity in the community. And then this is even more so in the last principle of cordiality. The last one is, it says, the last principle of cordiality is to have right view. And right view is here is defined as the view that is liberating, the view that brings emancipation, that brings freedom, the view that leads us from clinging, craving, contraction, cautness, closed down, whatever you want to call this, the prison we're in. So there's a view, there's an understanding, a perspective that moves us towards freedom. Some people say it's the Four Noble Truths. That view of the Four Noble Truths is a view that points us towards liberation, shows us. So have that view. And this view also, having right view, which again can seem very much like something you do personally for yourself, view that's emancipating, that's liberating, this leads to harmony and concord and friendliness and love. And to cap this off, the Buddha says, of these six principles of cordiality, the one that's most effective for creating love and respect and concord is having right view. Have the view that leads towards freedom. That's quite a championing of, you know, this personal practice and right view and concentration and virtue. Loving kindness is great. It's three of the six principles. But do your practice. There's something very powerful about doing your own practice that benefits the world around you. It's not possible to do it just for yourself. Practice is done, whether you want it or not, you do it for the sake of all beings. And I kind of believe that at some point, it's kind of hard to continue doing the practice unless you really feel you're doing it, the motivation comes from to support and help others as well. It's part of the motivation that keeps the practice going after a certain point. And just as there's this natural process inside of us, the conditions are right, moves us in the direction of healing, moves us along the Dharma path, deepens us, opens us, and all that. So there's a natural process, I think, in society and communities as well, that we can trust. We can trust that if we stay close to the Dharma practice, we stay close to, if you don't like the word Dharma, stay close to virtue, stay close to concentration, mindfulness, stay close to right view, the view that's liberating. Practice these things, that these, there's The impermanence is not chaotic and random. This is conducive and supportive of the society that we're in, the communities we're in. And to trust that that is so. And what I am confident to say is that mistrusting it does not help anyone. Mistrusting the practice, mistrusting virtue, mistrusting freedom and liberation, kind of is more with conditions that keep the world locked up. And that doesn't work. Clinging doesn't help anyone. Non-clinging helps everyone. So as you leave a retreat like this, I think probably most of you know that the states that, you know, the experiences you have will come and go. Sometimes they'll linger for a little while. Sometimes they disappear at the last bell of the retreat. And experiences are not so reliable, not something we should be so concerned with. But some of the lessons of the retreats and some of the trust and faith and confidence that we can have in ourselves and in the practice, in our community, that can linger, that can stay, that can be a refuge, that can be a source of inspiration, especially when things get difficult, times when it's difficult to practice or we are caught. And then to come back to that trust, that faith, the refuge, maybe can help open things up again, open ourselves up and settle back. So that it's not just the cashier that you stand up and look up at and have a human contact with. Maybe you'll stand up, stand straight, and have a human contact with yourself too.